Well, this sermon, as Mary alluded to, was inspired by the rise of anti-vaccination sentiment and concomitant breakouts of diseases like measles that we thought we had said goodbye to in this country in recent months and years. And I framed it exactly as she said in the blurb telling you what the sermon was about, kind of an individual versus community question. And I want to talk about that a little bit because I think that's a partial but not completely adequate ethical frame. We're talking about the many, many issues that come out of this one ethical question. So I hope you'll come along with me as I kind of share my various thinking that has come out of the good conversations that have arisen from the fact that some people are saying, I don't want to vaccinate, usually my children or myself. But before I get to that, I don't intend to spend this sermon saying what our national or state or church policy should be about vaccinations, although I'll touch on that. I will just say, although I would welcome a conversation with anybody who feels opposed to them, I feel that in my own heart, that this question is easy to settle. That vaccinations are not only a good idea, they're one of the most elegant and positive things to have come out of medical science in its entire history. You know, they use our own immune system in order to train our bodies to do against otherwise deadly diseases what it naturally does, what they naturally do less effectively. And although all medical interventions carry some risk, it's clear to me that the risk is far outweighed by the benefits in this case. Nevertheless, that doesn't resolve the whole question, which in some way is the ethical question. How do we make decisions when we don't, decisions that affect the whole community and affect many, many people, when we don't all agree on what our needs are, or even on what the truth is? So as I said, I framed it as individual versus community, but really, you can frame all such arguments as really individuals versus individuals, and many would argue that you should, because it's individuals who suffer. It's individuals who decide. We have consciences. A community does not have a conscience. An individual makes an ethical decision. And it's important to realize that when we make decisions about whether we get vaccinations and where we go if we didn't, we're affecting other individuals. So it's individual people here in this community who have to weigh, can I come into this space, go on BART where somebody might have had been there with measles hours before and it's still in the air, just be out in public if I'm the parent of an infant. Say there's an infant, I'm carrying an infant around who can't be fully vaccinated yet. I'm in the early stages of pregnancy and it would be extremely dangerous to encounter certain things like rubella. I can't get fully vaccinated or have the full strength of vaccinations because I'm undergoing chemo or I'm HIV positive. These are individual people, and likewise the whole question of freedom comes in, because then people are faced with the question of whether to quarantine themselves in order to be safe. Can we be safe and free? It's like the quote says in our order of service, it's been attributed to Oliver Wendell Holmes and many other famous people, but actually it's just an adage that was in the air and used an awful lot, interestingly, in the U.S. temperance movement, that my right to swing my arm ends where your nose begins. Or if you think of it more constructively this way, your right to swing your arm ends where my nose begins. We have competing individual needs. And so it is individual versus individual at times when we're making ethical decisions, and perhaps they can all be framed that way. And yet there is this question of community and individual in more profound ways, perhaps, I think, as I say, I'll meander around, but come back to the importance of community and what that means. Interestingly, this phrase that's been a motto of the United States for so long, e pluribus unum, out of many, one, it stands for that individual, pluribus, and the unum, unity, the fact that we are many, many people, and we are one. And what's so interesting is that nowadays it's under attack for the pluribus piece, the diversity piece, the piece that gives rise to the awareness that we are individuals. And it's been taken off official commemorative presidential coins, I think, because many of the president's supporters are very uncomfortable with the idea that diversity is a strength of ours as a country. Nativist commentators say, what's so great about diversity? It doesn't give rise to anything good. And so they take issue with this statement. But as I say, it's ironic because in the tension between pluribus and unum, it's the pluribus that reminds us that we're each individuals with our own needs, our own desires, and that we have to carefully negotiate and balance them in order to get to that unum. Another motto, the Vermont motto, as their state motto is freedom and unity, another way to put it. How do we balance our freedom with our desire to be one? But anyway, the question is, you know, what do we do when these clash? And one solution that we rely on, including in the question of vaccinations, of course, is rules, laws. In other words, compulsion, backed by force, if necessary. So the question is that our only recourse? We decide together, democratically, one hopes, what the rules are going to be, and then we require people to abide by them, backing it up with force if we need to. In terms of the anti-vax debate, that's played out as a requirement that all children be vaccinated before they come to school. I'm not saying they shouldn't, it sounds like a good policy to me, but it has its limits. For example, I was chatting with a bioethics expert in our congregation, Ryan Holmes, after the service. I really wanted to chat with him before the service. We're meeting on Friday, and I'm sure he's gonna give me all sorts of wisdom that I wish I had before this. He said it was good, though, so you know, you can stick with the sermon. He said, yeah, so you know, we did that, and now already, of course, people are getting out of that, around that. They just find a doctor who's sympathetic to write the note about why they can't have their child vaccinated. And so now there are new laws in the works to try to close that loophole, and you know, you could go up the appeals forever. Likewise, in conversations with colleagues, people have talked about, do you do anything about this? Do you have any kind of policy at church? Well, we could have a policy that you have to be vaccinated before you come to religious education. But the fact is, although our kids are registered, they have a lot more bureaucracy when it comes to protecting our legal minors than anybody else. We also want religious education to be open, that a child can bring a friend, for example, that day. So are we going to say, no, that friend can't come in, we haven't seen their paperwork? The way a kindergarten will literally say, no, you cannot come to kindergarten until we have seen your immunization record. And it wouldn't solve the problem for church anyway, because we're not going to ask at the door for every single person to show their immunization record. You just come to church. And we don't know who is particularly vulnerable and who has not gotten the vaccinations that they could well have in order to protect others. So what are we to do if we don't have these alternatives to force, if we need alternatives to force? Well, one is reason, of course. The acceptance of common norms. In other words, we trust the science. And I think what we're seeing is that these are breaking down. And when these break down, an agreement on what constitutes reason and what constitutes trustworthy authority, then we find ourselves scrambling. Then we resort to force. Which again might be necessary in terms of public health, but as it devolves in our country, I think we're seeing that it's not enough. If we don't resort to force, we have other means, such as name-calling, shaming, which it would also be good not to use in the wider community and certainly in a faith community. But there's something else that binds us together, even in our disagreements, and it's what Mary suggested in the quote she shared at the end of her reflection, that we have a shared goodwill and certain assumptions we can count on almost everybody to share. That whatever people decide, this is true about vaccinations and all sorts of other ethical decisions, but it's particularly good to look at this one. Whatever they decide, they're making that choice because they want to keep people safe. They want to keep their children safe. They want to keep all children safe. And likewise, no one is trying to make things dangerous or less free for the people who are vulnerable, for the people who do have compromised immune systems or are too young to be immunized or too old for it to take full effect. So could we begin there? I mean, ethically, not just practically. Like, that has to be the basis of ethics. To start with something we share, our unum. We want everyone to be as safe and as free as possible. I think this debate shows that we need something that broad, that deep and soul-based in order to have not only a thriving society, but even just a tolerable one. So, for example, just yesterday on the radio, my eyes lit up because, oh my, this is like what I'm talking about. Michael Lewis, who's the author of Moneyball and other books, was talking about mistrust, the growth of mistrust in our country. He was speaking specifically about the refereeing of basketball games, NBA games. We don't trust the refs, he said. Now, he took that in a different and very interesting direction than my mind was going. And it's really worth exploring. So you can get it on the website of This American Life, which is where he was speaking. He thought, and we can see the relevance to our country, that it had a lot to do with entitlement. Because he says the people who are arguing with the refs, who are saying, no, we don't want to trust in this impartial person to be fair, were the big stars. Steph Curry, sorry, folks, LeBron James. They're doing the most arguing and the most threatening of the referees, as if those who have more and more power don't want the system to be fair. They want to prevail. They want the rules not to apply to them. I can see how that could apply in other places besides basketball. But I was thinking about another kind of mistrust, about how our growing mistrust of authority is so broad that we can't find a common language, or we have not found a common language for what we can trust, where we can all begin. Specifically, in this case, the case of vaccinations, mistrust of science. Both scientists and the community of people who promote science, such as the Centers for Disease Control. Now, it's important to know that science and these kinds of agencies have not always been trustworthy. Time and again, we find out that, and surely today, somebody out there is falsifying results, or an agency is looking the other way, or choosing selectively, which studies they will pay attention to. It's happened before, and surely it will continue to happen. And so questioning and doubt should never cease. But it's clear, if you have to try to have these conversations across the line between vaxxers and anti-vaxxers, that we're not even looking at the same research, a reliable authority. And as we look out at the wider society, the depth of the problem of mistrust is such that two people might not even be able to agree on what somebody said when it's on tape and they're both watching it. So why the NBA thinks that having refs be able to go to the replay center for authority that's going to work is beyond me. I'm just waiting for the next level of appeal to be invented. We need, if we are to make ethical decisions together and weigh the needs of individuals, we need to restore a sense not of unquestioning trust in scientific authority, you know, those benevolent dictators in white coats we know. You don't want to go back to those days where we just believe anything anybody says because they have a PhD. So not unquestioning trust, but a sense of knowing how to question and investigate enough that we can then say, okay, I can provisionally trust this information. I see this happening all the time, that people don't seem to know what they can trust, and so the answer is, well, I just don't trust anything. You can make up anything, they say. A conspiracy could just as easily be true as, you know, I see that person walking across the street with my own eyes. Anything could be true. I think that kind of trust is built ultimately on community, on conversation, on knowing who the people are we are talking about and talking to. And so we're in this downward spiral right now, you know, because mistrust makes for less sense of community, and then when you have less sense of community, you have fewer people you trust, and so down it goes. The hopeful thing about downward spirals is that they come with their own built-in instructions about how to turn them around. More community leads to greater trust, and greater trust leads to you being able to create a greater sense of the community around you, and so it improves. We need communities of inquiry, communities of discussion, and there's no way, I think, to build it except to do it and keep building out from there. You know, long before this this republic was founded, we were warned about what human life is like if we don't have this kind of trust, this kind of agreement. Thomas Hobbes said that without it, life would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Now, he thought that the only solution was one particular kind of government, a strong monarchy. Everybody adheres to the authority of one central person, and then life can thrive. Obviously, we didn't agree. We radically insisted that democracy could suffice. That's the experiment we're undertaking. Is it enough? Once in a while, this joke goes around. You know, when things are going really bad, really badly in the United States, for example, you know, an election goes the way a lot of people wish it didn't go, or possibly even a majority wish it didn't go. This joke makes its way around the internet, in which Queen Elizabeth II addresses her erstwhile subjects and says, clearly you are unable to govern yourself. So we are taking over once again. Let me tell you certain things that are going to change. And then we learned the correct way to pronounce aluminium and the correct way to spell labor and color and marvelous and traveler. And once again, we will all be British subjects and this will be done properly. Well, I think democracy can suffice. I think we've proven that. And of course it does partly through doing the same things that a monarchy does, except more democratically, through power. We license some people to use force to enforce our agreed upon laws, the laws that we determined democratically, or in a smaller organization like this one, our rules, our guidelines. But as we're seeing, that's not always enough. You know, we have the rules, we have the laws. We also need a certain communal agreement if we're going to create that upward spiral. We inquire together. We bring our questions and doubts and what about this is together, and we listen respectfully without shaming, with lots of room for mistakes and therefore with an air of forgiveness. In other words, we make a community like this one. Community isn't just a collection of individuals, although maybe when it comes to rights, that's what we have to speak about, each person's rights and needs. Community is an absolutely essential good, like water, like air. And like those things, a poisoned community, well, it's like poisoned air, like polluted water. Instead of sustaining life, it destroys it. It does just the opposite of what it's meant to do. So we have to, there's only one way to make a trusting community, that's to be in community. But it's also so important to remember how essential that is to our freedom. That's why I love that hymn, the old Thanksgiving hymn that was rewritten by two UUs, Dorothy and Robert Sangus. The way it closes, when bound by human care and hope, then we are free. It's saying, it's not that community and individual freedoms are in tension, although of course they are. But we have to remember that we can't have what we need as individuals. We can't have the freedom we crave, the freedom on which this country and this religion were founded, if we don't have community, if we aren't bound together. Such a great choice of words. We are bound together tightly. That is what makes us free. That care, that hope. As Caitlin said at our centering words, we are deeply social beings. We can't have what we need outside of these communities. The communities we form, in turn, form us. And so if we are to have an ethics, if we are to make individual ethical decisions that allow us to be both safe and free and all the other qualities that we value, well, the question is what kind of community we are going to make. What kind of community do we need to create in order to create ourselves as we want to become? Because we are bound to human care and hope. The care for the hope in every single person in our community. What kind of community must we create in order to build that trust in which we can all be free? Let us keep inquiring and creating it together. Blessed be.